Penguin Random House Audio presents The Square and the Tower, Networks, Hierarchies, and the Struggle for Global Power by Neil Ferguson. Read for you by Elliot Hill. If I broke my silence, the strength would depart from me. But while I held my peace, I held my foe in an invisible mesh. George MacDonald. Preface. The Networked Historian. We live in a networked world, or so we are constantly told. The word network, which was scarcely used before the late 19th century, is now overused as both a verb and a noun. To the ambitious young insider, it is always worth going to the next party, no matter how late it is, for the sake of networking. Sleep may be appealing, but the fear of missing out is appalling. To the disgruntled old outsider, on the other hand, the word network has a different connotation. The suspicion grows that the world is controlled by powerful and exclusive networks. The bankers, the establishment, the system, the Jews, the Freemasons, the Illuminati. Nearly all that is written in this vein is rubbish. Yet it seems unlikely that conspiracy theories would be so persistent if such networks did not exist at all. The problem with conspiracy theorists is that, as aggrieved outsiders, they invariably misunderstand and misrepresent the way that networks operate. In particular, they tend to assume that elite networks covertly and easily control formal power structures. My research, as well as my own experience, suggests that this is not the case. On the contrary, informal networks usually have a highly ambivalent relationship to established institutions, and sometimes even a hostile one. Professional historians, by contrast, have, until very recently, tended to ignore or at least to downplay the role of networks. Even today, the majority of academic historians tend to study the kinds of institution that create and preserve archives as if those that do not leave an orderly paper trail simply do not count. Again, my research and my experience have taught me to beware the tyranny of the archives. Often, the biggest changes in history are the achievements of thinly documented, informally organized groups of people. This book is about the uneven ebb and flow of history. It distinguishes the long epochs in which hierarchical structures dominated human life from the rarer but more dynamic eras when networks had the advantage, thanks in part to changes in technology. To put it simply, when hierarchy is the order of the day, you are only as powerful as your rung on the organizational ladder of a state, corporation, or similar vertically ordered institution. When networks gain an advantage, you can be as powerful as your position in one or more horizontally structured social groups. As we shall see, this dichotomy between hierarchy and network is an oversimplification. Nevertheless, some personal disclosures may illustrate its usefulness as a starting point. On the night in February 2016, when I wrote the first draft of this preface, I attended a book party. The host was the former mayor of New York. The author, whose work we had gathered to celebrate, was a Wall Street Journal columnist and former presidential speechwriter. I was there at the invitation of the editor-in-chief of Bloomberg News, whom I know because we attended the same Oxford College more than a quarter of a century ago. At the party, I greeted and briefly conversed with about 10 other people, among them the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, the chief executive officer of Alcoa Inc., one of America's largest industrial companies, the editor of the journal's comment pages, a presenter on Fox News, a member of New York's Colony Club and her husband, and a young speechwriter who introduced himself by saying he had read one of my books, which is, without fail, the right way to strike up a conversation with a professor. At one level, it is obvious why I was at that party. The fact that I have worked at a succession of well-known universities, Oxford, Cambridge, New York, Harvard and Stanford, automatically makes me part of multiple webs of college alumni. As a consequence of my work as a writer and professor, I have also joined a number of economic and political networks, such as the World Economic Forum and the Bilderberg meetings. I am a member of three London clubs and one in New York. I presently belong to the boards of three corporate entities, one a global asset manager, one a British think tank, one a New York museum. And yet, despite being relatively well networked, I have almost no power. An interesting feature of the party was that the former mayor took the opportunity, in his short speech of welcome, to hint, not very enthusiastically, that he was considering entering as an independent candidate the contest to choose the next US president. But as a British citizen, I could not even vote in that election. Nor would an endorsement from me in any way have helped his or any other candidate's chances. For, as an academic, I'm assumed by the overwhelming majority of Americans to be wholly detached from the real lives of ordinary people. Unlike my former colleagues at Oxford, I do not control undergraduate admissions. When I taught at Harvard, I could award good or mediocre grades to my students, but I had essentially no power to prevent even the weakest of them from graduating. I had just won among many senior faculty votes when it came to PhD admissions. Again, no power. I have a measure of power over the people who work for my advisory firm, but in the space of 5 years, I have fired a grand total of one employee. I am a father of four, but my influence, never mind power, over three of these children is minimal. Even the youngest, who is five, is already learning how to defy my authority. In short, I am just not a very hierarchical person. By choice, I am more of a networks guy. As an undergraduate, I enjoyed the lack of stratification in university life, particularly the multitude of haphazardly organized societies. I joined many and turned up irregularly to few. My two favorite experiences at Oxford were playing the double bass in a jazz quintet, an ensemble that to this day prides itself on not having a leader, and participating in the meetings of a small conservative discussion club called the Canning. I opted to become an academic because in my early 20s I strongly preferred freedom to money. Seeing my contemporaries and their fathers employed in traditional vertical management structures, I shuddered. Observing the Oxford dons who taught me, fellows of a medieval corporate entity, citizens of an ancient republic of letters, sovereigns in their book-lined studies, I had an irresistible urge to follow in their leisurely, leathery footsteps. When academic life turned out to be rather less well-remunerated than the women in my life seemed to expect, I strove to earn without submitting to the indignity of real employment. As a journalist, I preferred to be a freelance, at most a part-timer, preferably a columnist on a retainer. When I turned to broadcasting, I wrote and presented as an independent contractor, and later formed my own production company. Entrepreneurship has suited my love of freedom, though I would say that I have founded companies more to remain free than to become rich. The thing I enjoy most is writing books about subjects that interest me. The best projects, the history of the Rothschild banks, the career of Sigmund Warburg, the life of Henry Kissinger, have come to me through my network. Only very recently did I appreciate that they were also books about networks. Some among my contemporaries pursued wealth. Few achieved it without at least a period of indentured servitude, usually working for a bank. Others pursued power. They too rose through the party ranks and must marvel today at the indignities they once endured. There are humiliations in the early years of academic life, no doubt, but nothing to compare with being an intern at Goldman Sachs or a lowly campaign volunteer for the losing candidate of a party in opposition. To enter the higher...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?